Welcome back to Restless Viking Radio. I'm Chuck. Last week we were out in the water on one of those trips where things start simple and slowly reveal how little control you actually have. This week's story goes back much further. Before the trips, before the projects, before I had much say in anything at all. It's about a man named Gerald, an old truck, and the first time someone handed me real responsibility and walked away. This story is called What Makes You So Special. The F700 rode like a trailer full of sheet metal. Through the floorboards, I could watch the road rush past between my tennis shoes. Every so often, chunks of pavement and gravel-filled holes would rush past. I set up as straight as I could. I was finally old enough to see over the dashboard. Seventh grade had ended the week before. Now it was summer, and that meant work, every day except Sunday. Gerald drove us to the gravel pit in his pickup that morning. He jumped into the driver's seat of the big blue beast when we pulled in. The old truck had a bed of weathered planks and wooden stakes built to haul firewood, not stone. The boards were splintered, the paint faded from years of sun. It looked like it belonged in a painting of an old farm. He didn't say anything. I assumed I was supposed to climb in. We rattled down the hill toward a loader that was busy scooping washed stone into a pile. The operator swung toward us quickly and the bucket rose. It spilled stones over its lip. The first load clambered lightly onto the wood bed. The truck rocked as the bucket rotated, dumping the payload fast. Gerald was calm as he checked the side view mirror. I craned my neck, trying to see through the slats as the stones rattled into the back. All I saw were flashes of white dust. The bucket came again. More noise, more white dust. The boards bowed a bit at the bottom, but held. He nodded, then worked the long stick shift between us, and we started up the long hill. The engine roared hard as we rocked back and forth. The truck pushed into the climb, resenting every yard. We stopped at a small office near the road and rolled onto a metal plate. Gerald climbed out of the truck. I looked through the open door and the window of the shack. I saw him leaning over a lonely desk. He was writing something on a white slip. When he climbed back in, he stuffed the paper into the dented ashtray. Then he pushed the long stick forward and we crawled and groaned toward the highway. Dust swirled around us as we stopped at the edge of the road. Then we jerked forward and out of the billowing cloud and gathered speed. 12 miles later, we pulled into a house with green wrap and new plywood. Two guys were putting on siding. Out back was a wide square hole. It was shallow and seemed to take up the entire backyard. It had stones spread on the bottom and a carefully laid grid of white pipe. Gerald turned sharply into the loose yard with the steering wheel sawing back and forth. The truck groaned as it rocked on the soft ground. He stopped, pushed the gear lever, and backed up, staring into a side mirror. He pulled the long stick back and forth, let his foot off the far pedal, and the engine kept running unevenly. He shouldered the door and stepped out, leaving the driver's side door wide open. I looked out the door, at the dirt, trees, and silence where he had been. Then I turned to get out. I reached for the door handle. It wasn't there. I searched for it. Nothing. I cranked the window down and leaned out, pawing at the handle on the outside. When I finally caught it, the door popped open and I tumbled out of the cab. The engine coughed behind us as I stood next to him, staring at the same hole with stones in it. I was trying to understand what I was looking at. It was a neat layer of stone with white pipe laid in a rectangle, two lines stretched through the center. Stakes with orange streamers stood among piles of dirt. The trees had scars where equipment had clipped them. I could smell the stones and the damp sand. The pipes ran to two huge concrete vaults and then toward the house. Septic tanks, I guessed. Gerald stood there with his hands on his hips, stared at it for a long pause. Damn them, he said, looking up. It's going to take at least 5 loads, Charlie. I tried to piece it all together. Then he turned to me, and he asked me like I knew something. Don't you think? I mirrored him, my hands on my hips, a deep contemplating stare. Yeah, I said, stretching my word, trying to sound confident. He held my eyes for a second. Jump in and back it up. He turned away and started walking toward the concrete tanks. I stood there frozen with my elbows flared out like I was posing for something. I kept waiting for him to turn around, but he didn't. I turned toward the open driver's door, still watching him, and I nearly walked straight into the bed of the truck. I froze, my face inches from the bed. The stone sloped toward the back, smooth and waiting. Let's go, he barked as he turned around and marched toward me, his arms waving to get moving. I sprinted to the truck's driver door, kicking dirt. I jumped inside and jerked the door closed. It gently opened back up. I pulled again. It wouldn't latch. I grabbed it with both hands and heaved on it. It finally clicked into place. I tried to get my bearings. Everything was vibrating and alive. I saw a grid with numbers on the big shifting lever. There were numbers and an R printed on the top of the knob. Reverse, I thought. I pulled the lever over and back. The stick buzzed and metal groaned. Oh, shit. I let go. Clutch. Like a tractor. I remember the far pedal and pushed. It didn't really move, so I leaned back, pushing my back against the seat and pushed hard. It went to the floor. Then I pulled the lever into reverse. It bumped into place and I slowly let go, my hand sprawling just above it. Good, I thought. I started letting the clutch out and the engine quieted and struggled. The truck barely moved and almost quit. Gas, I thought. I pushed the gas pedal and the engine roared and sputtered. Then I slowly let the clutch out and nothing happened. I let more out, then a little more. I pushed on the gas just a little and the engine roared again. Exhaust poured into the cab as the truck jerked and hopped. What are you doing? Gerald called out. The doors rattled. I pushed on the gas. The engine popped and screamed to life. Let's go. Let the clutch out. I jerked my foot off the pedal and everything heaved and coughed. Everything lurched backward. My chest hit the steering wheel and we were free. Everything passed in a blur. The truck roared backwards and then, bam! Everything quit. My ears were ringing. It was dead silent. Everything rocked forward a few inches and stopped. The engine had quit. I looked in the mirror and saw a tree that stood right by the corner of the bed, a tan scar where I'd clipped it. I looked out my window at Gerald. He stood there, hands on his hips, and waited. I waited. What the hell are you doing, Charlie? I don't know, I yelled back. He studied me, his face empty. God damn it, start it up, pull her forward. I looked at the dash panel of cracked gauges, plungers, and knobs. Then I saw a shiny silver key hanging from the ignition. I twisted it. The truck went rrr and lurched back into the tree. Gerald waited. I looked down at my feet. My ears were still ringing. Clutch, damn it. I pushed the clutch, turned the key, and the truck popped, coughed, and roared back to life. I found the tree in the mirror as we groaned forward. I clutched, slammed the stick in reverse. The engine roared. I slowly released the clutch all the way. The sound hummed in waves as I moved to miss the tree. The stones in the hole slid into view and it got bigger. I caught Gerald's hand waving me to keep going. The edge of the pit got larger as the truck moved closer and closer. Gerald dropped his hand and waited. I watched the rearview mirror as the back tire chewed dirt and crept toward the edge. The whole world narrowed to those rotating tires. And just as it reached a lip, I slammed on the brakes and pushed my foot hard on the clutch. And I sat there with my back arched and legs shaking, holding the pedals down like I was bracing a door closed, the back tires inches from the hole. Gerald studied the rear of the truck. Then he looked at me. He waited. I waited. Well, dump it. How? I bellowed. His eyebrows shot up, his shoulders tightened. He thought for a moment. Pull the red plunger, he yelled, then quieter. I think. I looked down, a red and black knob vibrating against the dash. They were as big as half a baseball, shaking nervously. I grabbed the red one and pulled. The truck protested with a grinding buzz that I felt in my hand. Put the clutch in first, Gerald barked. I shoved the clutch hard, pulled it again. Something engaged and a new groan came to life under the floorboards. It was a higher pitch than the engine, fast at first, then slowed and labored. I looked back over my shoulder. Now pull the back one! I turned back and yanked the back plunger. For a second, nothing happened. Then the slatted boards behind me began to rise. One side lifted first, uneven, then it straightened out and rose, unforgiving. The rocks began to rattle and slide, slow at first, then all at once. The truck rocked as dust curled up from the back. Then a sliding rattle noise covered the noise of the engine. The sound slowed to a trickle. Pull ahead, Gerald said as he walked forward to inspect the new pile I had just dumped in the hole. I pulled ahead, slowly. A few moments later, I heard the crack of wood. The truck bumped as it groaned forward. Leaves fell, twigs fell, then a small branch slammed on the hood. I pushed the brake and clutch in, shifted into neutral, and slammed my shoulder into the door. It popped open and I fell out onto the ground. I looked up at the bed of the truck angled high in the air, a tree branch speared into the sidewall of the boards. I looked at Gerald. He was still staring down into the pit. I climbed back in fast, pushed the plungers back in. The bed started coming down with a whoosh. I watched it settle on the frame. I climbed on the cab and strained to reach the branch. I jerked. It didn't budge. I pulled. Nothing. Gerald was walking back. Let's go, he called. We climbed back into the truck. Gerald settled in on the passenger side with one elbow on his window ledge. He said nothing and looked straight ahead. I pushed the clutch in and eased it into gear. The truck bucked once, then settled into its familiar noise. At the gravel pit, he pointed. Always park facing out. Don't turn around with a load. I nodded. Keep your foot on the brake when they dump. Don't shut the truck off. I listened hard. He talked even and firm, like it wasn't anything. I kept my foot firm on the brake as the loader swung toward us. I watched the bucket climb. Stone thundered into the bed. The truck rocked quickly, then steadied as the load settled in. On the way out of the pit, he said, "Don't shift. Hold it at this RPM." The truck howled all the way up the hill. Just before the scales, he told me to stop. He climbed out, then he stood holding the door as I looked down at him. "When you get back there, use the wheelbarrow. Rake it out even, 3 or 4 inches over the pipe. Lay straw over it. You got it?" I nodded. He shut the door and walked over to his pickup parked off to the side. He climbed in and pulled away. I rolled the truck forward onto the big metal plate. The engine idled loudly and fast. I waited for the truck to settle on the scale. Then I climbed down and walked inside the small office, not sure what to expect. The tension seemed to slip off as I stood in the dusty office. I gazed at the 2 metal chairs against a bare wall and a calendar tacked up beside the window. On an old desk was a receipt pad. Behind it was a huge round dial with a trembling needle. "Is that the weight?" I thought. I stood there for a moment, listening to the truck idle outside. The top yellow page of the receipt pad had Sand Lake Lumber scrawled across the top in block letters. Beneath it were 2 numbers. I looked at the dial again, then back at the pad. The larger number was close to what the scale's arrow was pointing at. That must be how much the truck weighs, I thought. What was the other number? I copied the number from the dial, then decided the second number was the weight of the truck. I walked back outside as the truck engine stumbled as it idled. I climbed back into the cab, folded the white slip of paper once, and pushed it into the dented ashtray. I shifted, eased the clutch out, and headed toward town. I drove through town, past my parents' craft store, and past the restaurant where I drank coffee in the morning and tried to eat pancakes that didn't really settle. I kept both hands on the wheel. I could feel the weight of the dust in my hair. The truck wound loudly through town as I kept it in second gear. At the edge of town, Rick was sitting in the Sand Lake squad car waiting to turn left. I could see his mustache. He was my former Little League coach. He was also the town police chief. I could see him crouching down to watch me through his windshield. I watched back, my seat bouncing a little. He lifted a hand and waved. I almost didn't wave back, but I raised 2 fingers, careful not to take my hand off the steering wheel. As I passed him, I could feel my heart beating hard. I was certain he was about to pull out and light me up. I checked the mirror. He pulled onto the road and went the other direction. At the house, I backed up cleaner this time. Not perfect, just better. Then 4 more loads. I spread the stone with a wheelbarrow and rake, measured 3 or 4 inches over the pipe. I broke the straw bales and wiggled it across the top of the stone. No lunch. I didn't know how to take lunch yet. By 4:30, it was done. Sweat soaked my shirt and my hands stung from blisters. The lumberyard closed at 5:30. I drove the truck back to the lumberyard and parked it where it was that morning. I shut it off. The silence after the engine died felt really loud. I walked inside. Gerald was gone. Scotty, the guy that was always behind the counter, told me to go out and stack boards, make the piles of the lumber look neat. No one said anything about the truck, or the loads, or the straw. When we locked up, I stood there for a second, not sure what I was waiting for. Then I walked down the road, away from the yard gate, toward my parents' store. My arms were sunburned and grimy, my hands were still stinging. The day felt lazy, with a soft buzz of summer insects. The morning seemed like a lifetime ago. By the time I was 17, I was no longer riding along. It was 4 summers later. The rain came and went unevenly as I rode with Gerald to the deer ranch. It would fall hard for a minute, then turn to mist, then hard again. The windshield wipers of the pickup swept fast, long after the rain had stopped. The sun threw a few tentative beams between the clouds. The morning had been busy. I fixed a truck that refused to start, insulated the walls of a new house. I reorganized a binder of land contracts, calculating interest rates and updating the payment schedules. I ran a crew of guys he brought in when the work piled up. He'd always find the guys with the outstanding warrants who were one step ahead of disaster. They weren't efficient, but they were loyal for at least a day. We picked up parts after lunch to resurrect a pre-war industrial air compressor he had found at an auction in an abandoned factory. The reserve tank alone was big enough to live in. I needed new points and a relay to run it right. The deer population of the ranch had grown far beyond the available water troughs. We were digging a pond to give them a new water source, and the compressor was supposed to power the bubbler system in the winter to keep the ice from freezing over. The rain stopped by the time we reached the freeway, but Gerald didn't shut off the wipers that were still going at full speed. The rubber started to chatter a little against the dry glass. I glanced over and saw his head dip. He straightened and adjusted in his seat, eyes heavy, but still on the road. Then his head slowly dipped again. "Hey," I said, "wake up." He jerked slightly and settled back without looking at me. The wipers kept sweeping fast across the windshield. And we passed our exit. It was Friday, and between my own projects and work, I hadn't slept much either. I looked out the window and didn't say anything. The truck hummed along, the wipers whipped across the glass. After a stretch of silence, he spoke. You know, Charlie, money's like an ice cube. You let it sit in a bank, it's just gonna melt. I nodded. He didn't look at me. Two exits later, he jumped when he saw the sign. Holy shit, Charlie, how'd you let me miss the exit? I didn't say anything at first. Then I said, I could use the extra break. He looked over, a small smirk tugging at the corner of his mouth. Oh, yeah? He said, almost like he was suspicious. Well, shit, he said as we exited the freeway. We circled back onto the expressway. There weren't many cars. The rain had stopped entirely, but the wipers were still on high. We got off at the right exit, and he reached up and finally turned the wipers off. Then he suddenly asked what I planned to do with my life. College, I said. Then probably open my own business. Own business? Yeah, I don't want to work for anyone. He kept his eyes on the road for a beat. Then he let out a quick grunt and shrugged his shoulders. What makes you so special? He said it out loud and seemed like he was dead serious, but I didn't answer. The rest of the afternoon moved fast. I pushed piles of dirt that the excavator left around the pond, leveling them out neatly. I replaced the points and relay on the compressor and cleaned the connectors. It started up and air moved through the lines. The air tank filled and the compressor shut off like it was supposed to. I walked out the barn door and looked down at the steady chain of bubbles in the pond. I stood there for a long moment, the bubbles spreading across the surface. I met with inspectors at a new house who came to approve the new drain field. One of them asked how old I was. 17, I said, like it was just a fact. You did this? He asked, nodding to the straw on the rocks. I did, I said, wondering what he wanted. He smiled and shook his head as he tore the approval from his pad and handed it to me. Just before closing, I finished setting up the first computer system the lumberyard ever had. And that evening, I sat at the long table in the restaurant with the other local business owners. I stared into my coffee as they talked about land deals, developments, and other information that quietly passes between coffee cups. Gerald sat next to me, listening more than he spoke. I looked over, and he was staring at me. He turned and looked back into the conversation. I was 17. 3.5 decades later, I was the same age he was then. Poppins and I pulled into the parking lot of the funeral home. The place looked like a brochure placed in the middle of town, the new landscape and brick siding with lanterns at the entrance. It looked more like a movie set than the town I grew up in. As I shut the car off, I looked at the trucks filling the parking lot and spilling onto the grass. I let the silence stretch. He sold the farm when he was my age and built his empire. Imagine starting over at my age, I said, as I absently put the key in my jacket pocket. Inside, I saw familiar faces. Some were more tired than I remembered. We were all much older. I greeted a few and introduced Poppins. They smiled, and we asked where the time went. Then they moved on into the crowd, and I looked around. And then I saw Trudy. She had cut firewood for a living when I had worked for Gerald. She was almost 20 years younger when she married him after he sold the farm. She stood near a small table with a few photographs and a few memories. There was a warm lamp beside a box of unused tissues. On the table was a tired old leather belt curled up. A cell phone pouch used for a flip phone was still attached. An old pocket knife stained with old grease and chipped on the handle. I felt my knife in my pocket. There was a dirty lighter in a bowl. I felt my own lighter. Neither of us smoked, but a lighter strips wire, starts junk fires. I had lit countless torches and furnaces with it. A ring of keys lay in the bowl, too. Half of them had probably forgotten what they opened. I felt my own in my pocket with its orphaned keys. A small tactical flashlight lay next to the lighter, and I could feel the weight of my own flashlight in my jacket. There was a notepad and a beat-up pen neatly laid beside the belt. Mine was in my left pocket. Charlie, Trudy called. Her eyes had softened over the years. Her smile was crooked and warm. Hey, Trudy. It was the first time I had ever hugged her. I introduced her to Poppins, and she remembered her. She looked at Poppins as she described the well-dressed, cute girl who once showed up at the lumberyard garage decades ago. Poppins looked at me and smiled. I pointed toward the table. Did you put this together? I asked Trudy. She didn't say anything at first. She looked down at the belt, the keys, the lighter, then back at me. That's Gerald, she said. I smiled a little, then nodded. I was 13 when I started working for Gerald. 13 isn't an age when people hand you anything real. You're usually just kept close enough to see, but not close enough to feel. You're not really close enough to matter. You carry things and you watch. They tell you that your time will come. Gerald didn't. He handed me work that could fail, work that affected customers and required judgment. He didn't hover. He didn't rush in to correct every wobble or if something broke. If it did break, I had to fix it. If something went wrong, I had to sort it out. There's a difference between being around responsibility and being given. It feels like pressure. When it's given, you try to keep up. You try not to disappoint a man who's building something in real time. Only later do you realize that something shifted. When we're trusted with weight before we're fully ready, you start to grow toward it. You stand a little different. You stop waiting for someone else to decide for you. And when that happens, you feel something straighten. We don't always do that with each other. We manage instead of trust. We direct instead of let go. We step in before someone gets a chance to carry their own load. And we mean well. A friend once told me that raising a kid is like catching a 10-pound fish in a 1-pound line. You don't fight it. You work with it. Gerald didn't waste words. He didn't lecture. He didn't have posters about empowerment or lean into agency. He just made space and expected you to step into it. He once asked me, "What makes you so special?" I didn't think he knew the answer. I didn't have an answer. I just had work. A lifetime of living is the only answer I have. It isn't what I built or what I earned. It's what I carried. Standing at that table with the belt, the knife, the lighter, the ridiculous ring of keys, I realized that they weren't gifts to give someone. They're just something you carry. The work never stops. It just changes hands. And when it does, something straightens. And one day, you look up. And you realize that you're no longer standing at the edges of the room. You're at the table. And now that you've made it to the table, you don't keep your place. You give it up. Sometimes a question stays with you longer than the person who asked it. What makes you so special? At the time, it didn't feel like a challenge. I felt like I still needed to grow into something. Years later, you realize something strange about those moments. The work changes hands, the responsibility moves, and suddenly you're the one standing where someone else stood. Next time on Restless Viking Radio, we head north to a lonely place on Lake Michigan called Poverty Island, where the work is showing up looks a little different. And where staying might matter more than leaving. I'll see you there.